Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Do human beings really have souls? And if so, what happens to them after our bodies cease to exist? And how do our ideas and beliefs and anxieties about what may or may not await us after we die inform the ways that we choose to live? As director of the Laboratory for Perception and Action at Baylor College of Medicine, David Eagleman's day job involves deciphering how our brains perceive the world we occupy right now. But he is also an ambitious and imaginative writer of fiction, who last year published a critically acclaimed collection of essays that conceive of existence after death in ways that differ wildly from the notions of mainstream religious tradition. The book is called Some, 40 Tales from the Afterlives, and it's out now in paperback. You can also read a terrific profile of Eagleman's work online in the Texas Observer in a piece that was originally published in May. David, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be here.
It would seem an unlikely thought exercise for a scientist, and yet over several years you've written something like 75 of these afterlife scenarios. Can you talk about why the subject appealed to you?
Yeah, well, I tell you, as a scientist, we go in every day and we sort of follow rules. We make up creative hypotheses, and then we follow rules to figure out which ones are true and not true. And what's nice about fiction is that you can make up really interesting scenarios and roll them out without any rules. And see where they go. And the toolbox of science has been essentially the most successful thing that we have implemented as humans. We have gotten ships to the moon and cured smallpox and polio and invented the internet. Science has been really successful. But a lot of things are just beyond the toolbox of science. And in the end, there's very little that we can... There are a few ways that we can actually gather evidence to weigh in favor of one story over another. So what's been interesting to me over the last decade as I've watched the debates between the atheists and the religious fundamentalists is that on both sides, people are sort of acting as though they know what's going on, which is quite funny to me because from a science point of view, we simply don't have any data about what's going on something like, let's say, the afterlife. So what I decided to do is write a book of short stories that each one takes place in a different possible afterlife, but the key is that they're all mutually exclusive stories, so that the meta message one gets from the book is about the vastness of our ignorance. It's about all the possibility space beyond talking about God versus no God, which I think is actually much too limited a debate for a modern discussion, given everything we know about the size of the cosmos and quantum mechanics and dark matter and consciousness and so on. It seems funny that all people are arguing about is, okay, well, there's some version of the man with the beard on the cloud, or there's nothing at all but the cold rules of physics in the cosmos, where, in fact, we could make up hundreds of more interesting stories about possibilities. Now, all the stories that I wrote in Some are meant to be funny and interesting and mischievous and shine light on our own life. But it's this meta message about our ignorance and uncertainty that emerges from the reading of the book.
So the fact is that no matter what we believe, one way or another, we can't possibly empirically know with existing technologies whether or not anything happens to our consciousness after our bodies dies. Does fiction make that fact more tolerable for you, or does it simply is it simply something to do with your unanswered question?
That's very interesting about the tolerable. Friedrich Nietzsche once said, art is what keeps us from dying of the truth. but that's actually not why I do art. For me, it's just, so as a scientist, I come into the laboratory every day, and the way science works is you make up wacky, creative stories. That's what you do every single day, and you try to figure out which ones are right. And the way you do that is you make up some story, and so you land on some bizarre island that no one's ever stepped on before, and you look back to what we know, you look back to the land, and you try to build a bridge. You see if you can sort of link what we already know to this new strange island, and if you can, then that's progress. But most of the time you can't. 9 out of 10 ideas are wrong, even though they're interesting and beautiful. And so I think literature gives me a vehicle at nighttime to then revisit those islands and explore those ideas and say, what if? So, during the day, I spend all my time doing what is, and then at nighttime, it's what if.
So let's give people some examples of this. I have to say, I think my very favorite story in the book is the very first one, which is called Some. Will you read that for us?
Sure, sure. In the afterlife, you relive all your experiences, but this time with the events reshuffled into a new order. All the moments that share a quality are grouped together. So you spend 2 months driving the street in front of your house, 7 months having sex. You sleep for 30 years without opening your eyes. For 5 months straight, you flip through magazines while sitting on a toilet. You take all your pain at once, all 27 intense hours of it. Bones break, cars crash, skin is cut, babies are born. Once you make it through, it's agony-free for the rest of your afterlife. But that doesn't mean it's always pleasant. You spend 6 days clipping your nails, 15 months looking for lost items, 18 months waiting in line, 2 years of boredom, staring out a bus window, sitting in an airport terminal, 1 year reading books. Your eyes hurt and you itch because you can't take a shower until it's your time to take your marathon 200-day shower. 2 weeks wondering what happens when you die. 1 minute realizing your body is falling. 77 hours of confusion. 101 hours realizing you've forgotten someone's name. 3 weeks realizing you are wrong. 2 days lying. 6 weeks waiting for a green light. 7 hours vomiting. 14 minutes experiencing pure joy. 3 months doing laundry. 15 hours writing your signature. 2 days tying shoelaces. 67 days of heartbreak. 5 weeks driving lost. 3 days calculating restaurant tips. 51 days deciding what to wear. 9 days pretending you know what is being talked about. 2 weeks counting money. 18 days staring into the refrigerator. 34 days longing. 6 months watching commercials. 4 weeks sitting in thought, wondering if there is something better you could be doing with your time. 3 years swallowing food. 5 days working buttons and zippers. 4 minutes wondering what your life would be like if you reshuffled the order of events. In this part of the afterlife, you imagine something analogous to your earthly life, and the thought is blissful. A life where episodes are split into tiny, swallowable pieces, where moments do not endure, where one experiences the joy of jumping from one event to the next, like a child hopping from spot to spot on the burning sand.
That is the short story, Some, from David Eagleman's book, Some, 40 Tales from the Afterlives. I think I like that for a variety of reasons. One is that it ultimately is sort of a celebration of the way we have to live things in the current life. And the other is that I think from the time I was a little kid, I used to imagine sort of a similar fantasy of the afterlife, except that mine would be zipping through to find the extremes in my life. So you suddenly learn on which day of your life you worked the hardest or when you had the most profound realization or when you were most in love. And those are all things that seem so close, and yet ultimately they're impossible for us in this life.
That's right. Your story should be the 41st story in the book. Yeah, it's a nice one. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. All of these stories, as one can see even from just this first story, they're not actual proclamations about the afterlife. Sometimes people get confused because sometimes people come to my book readings because they say, oh, I heard you were a neuroscientist and you wrote a book about the afterlife. And, you know, is it about near-death experiences or crossing over to the other side? But it's not anything like that. Instead, they're really stories that shine a light on the here and now. They're stories that shine a light on the joys and complexities of being human, which is, you know, the most interesting topic we have. And what I have found to be interesting in the process of writing this is whatever culture you're born into, you sort of inherit one main story. So for most of us in the West, it's the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition. It's some flavor of that story. And it really cuts across things at a very different angle and exposes new faces if you try shaking that up and giving a completely different view. So in some of my stories in the book, God is a female. In other stories, God is a married couple that's getting a divorce. In another story, God is the size of a microbe, and he doesn't know that we exist because we're at the wrong spatial scale, and he's not aware of us. And in many of the other stories, as you know, the God doesn't exist at all. It's not about God at all. In some, we were built by other creatures as sort of Mars rovers, and we have these terrific eyes and ears and fingers and so on, and we're built as these robots to collect planetary data. But it turns out those engineers who built us are very disappointed because all we do is take pictures of each other. We just stare at each other all the time. But it's this sort of shaking up of traditional stories and just taking a completely different, wacky angle on it that I think really allows the book to shine a light on all kinds of interesting aspects of our lives that maybe get missed under just the traditional umbrella.
Well, you know, David, reading through this, a lot of your, as you've just described, a lot of your afterlives are not utopias. And it caused me to realize that so many faith traditions promise only pleasure and only happiness for those who are fortunate enough to achieve eternal life.
That's right. Well, you know, this is the second story in the book. I immediately address that topic, where in the second story, God realizes that she submitted to peer pressure when she set up her universe like all the other gods had, with this binary categorization of people into good or evil, and this idea of having a heaven or a hell. And God, who's, you know, become more sophisticated and mature over the years, starts really suffering with this thing about, well, geez, I promised people either a utopia or a punishment, and people are so much more complicated than that. How can she possibly decide who gets, you know, eternal punishment reward? And she deeply comes to appreciate the multifaceted nature of humans and how complex they can be, how they can be good in some ways and really bad in other ways. And so in that story, she finally decides to just shut down hell and bring everybody to be by her side in heaven. And the sort of the conclusion of the story is that once she gives everybody true equality and everyone lives in heaven, it turns out that people are deeply dissatisfied with that. The communists are baffled and irritated because they've finally achieved their perfect society, but only by the help of a God in whom they don't want to believe. And the meritocrats are abashed that they're stuck in this incentiveless system for eternity with a bunch of communists. And the liberals have no impoverished people to promote, and the conservatives have no penniless people to disparage. And so God sits on the edge of her bed and weeps at night because the only thing everyone can agree upon is that they're all in hell.
Even after they've gotten everything they wanted. Well, it is sort of an object lesson in be careful what you wish for.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's right. And so for years I've sat next to people on airplanes and I've just asked them, what do you think? What are your religious views? Do you think there's an afterlife and what would it look like? And I've realized that the stories that most people carry around, if you just start scratching the surface of it even a little bit, you realize, God, that wouldn't be so great. It wouldn't be so great to live for eternity, you know, under these circumstances or this sort of thing. And I mean, imagine if you found yourself on a cloud with a harp and
I wouldn't want that now.
You know, it's unclear that after 1,000 years of that, you wouldn't feel a little bit bored. You know, maybe there's a great buffet set up and you can go and play bridge with your friends or something. But you can imagine this would get a little boring after eons.
David Eagleman is my guest. We're talking this hour about his book, Some, 40 Tales from the Afterlives.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David Eagleman. He is director of the Laboratory for Perception and Action at Baylor College of Medicine and author of the book Some, 40 Tales from the Afterlives. I think another one of the stories in the book, David, and forgive me because I'm not remembering the title at this moment, but talks about the fact that perhaps in the afterlife, suddenly we are able to really perceive ourselves for who and what we really are, which is something that, again, is impossible to do in this life. And that story interested me based on what you do in your day job at the lab every day, which is understanding human perception.
Yeah, that story is called Mirrors. And in that story, when you get to the afterlife, your ego is stripped away from you slowly, and all of the the filters that you have get stripped away, and all the people that you ever interacted with, all the people who know you, are all gathered together, and they hold up essentially mirrors to you that show you how they saw you. And you realize in this afterlife that you never knew yourself that well, which is why you don't even recognize your own voice on answering machine messages, or whenever you see a photograph of yourself, you always think, is that what I look like? So in this story, everyone's gathered and they hold up their mirrors to you. And without the benefit of filtration, you see yourself clearly for the first time. And that's what finally kills you. So it's sort of a, you know, it's sort of a dark, humorous, but black humor story, where if you were to really see how everyone else saw you, it would be tough on you. And yeah, I think that's part of, you know, that grows out of my understanding of the sort of psychological filters that we all construct in our interpretations of other people's behavior or reactions to us. In general, we make models of one another. When I'm saying something, I think, oh, well, how will Chris react to that, and vice versa. But in truth, our models of each other aren't that great. They're good enough to get by. And so, so the way that other people see you could, in theory, be quite different from the way you see yourself.
Well, what I love about that is that we are so, as human beings, we absolutely trust our senses and perceptions, and yet they're often wrong. Even the idea that we have had for so long, because this is how we experience it, that time is only a linear thing.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the main things I study in the lab, is time perception. And what I've found in the last 10 years is a large number of temporal illusions of time, where in the laboratory we can very easily make you think that something lasted longer or shorter than it actually did, or we can make you think that something came before something else, even though it was the other way around. It's very easy, actually, to manipulate the sense of time. This is all very new stuff. And what that tells us is, gosh, even though you open your eyes and you think that the world is just out there and you're just passively recording it, in fact, it's not like that. You're actively constructing it. And brains are all about building this grand illusion around us of vision and colors and time. And it doesn't take much to realize that when somebody gets brain damage, let's say from a stroke or traumatic brain injury, that it can change a lot. With vision, it's been known for a long time that with damage to particular parts of your brain, you can no longer see colors or see motion, let's say. Everything looks like a series of static snapshots instead of being smoothly moving. Things like this. Bizarre things that you would never think could break, but all these pieces and parts can break. And we've been finding the same thing with time, that with different kinds of brain damage or disease, there can be problems of time perception. And I'm pursuing a hypothesis right now. I think that schizophrenia, one of the main problems with it, maybe the fundamental problem, is actually a disorder of timing. And if that's right, I'm doing studies on this right now with schizophrenic patients and finding that indeed their time perception is quite different from normal. And it turns out that if this is right, it suggests an entirely different approach to treatment of the disease than has been done in the past, which is mostly just a shotgun approach where we discover, oh, some drug seems to diminish the symptoms, so why don't we just do that? But we don't have a good understanding of schizophrenia, and so this would be a real inroad.
How do you set experiments like that up in a lab?
Well, the nice part is over the years we've been able to hone them down to essentially a set of video games where we have people play these video games. And we can extract about 7 different measures of how their brain is doing things in the realm of time perception. And so I've put this whole series of tests together. I call it the Texas Temporal Battery. And I've been using this test on not only lots of control subjects, but veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan who have traumatic brain injury, and schizophrenic patients, and Parkinson's patients, and epilepsy patients. And the latest thing I'm doing, I just set this up yesterday. I just got back from London yesterday, and there's a British musician named Brian Eno who is the producer for groups like U2 and Coldplay. And so I've been interested in time perception with professional drummers who have really extraordinary sense of time. And so I just set up my tests on his computer in his studio, and we're going to test the drummer of U2 and Coldplay and several others to find out exactly how good human brains can be at the extremes at timing.
So for kids who worry that a career in science might be boring or leave them out of the action, they have only to look at your job.
Yeah, well, I've been very lucky to keep it, you know, highly caffeinated and fun.
David Eagleman is my guest. The new book is Some. Let's go to Gene in Dallas. Hi, Gene.
Hello, good afternoon. I want to thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two statements and one question for your guest. I really like the way he thinks. Initially, I was dismissing what he was saying. But when I heard him talk about the idea of God deciding, well, you know, life's been so difficult for folks. Why should I send anybody to hell? And God shut hell down, took everybody up in heaven, and the communists were disappointed, and everybody was just disappointed. The only thing they could agree on was that they were all miserable in hell. Now, there is a woman, her name is Ellen G. White, and she wrote a book in which she made a statement that God would not take folks in hell, not because he doesn't want to. He does. But folks would be so disappointed because it would not reach up to what they think heaven would be like. So I really like that part about your guest.
And let me just ask you really...
The question that I have...
Yeah, go ahead.
Question that I have is, what is the paradigm that he used to come to that particular illustration? Even though he has not settled on it, he's got this whole slew of stories. What paradigm did he use to derive that particular idea?
Thanks for your call. David?
Thanks. Well, something I should note is that all 40 stories, they were all stories that I made up from scratch, and I was trying to accomplish two things at once with every story, which is make it completely different from every other story and zoom in on and really explore some aspect of human nature. So my only paradigm, if we could even call it that, for this particular story was just zooming in on this nature of dissatisfaction that humans suffer with a lot, where they achieve their goals or get something, something wonderful happens. But they're, you know, we're sort of smart and critical, and we're able to always find flaws in something. So that was just an exploration of that idea.
You know, it's so interesting, David, that considering how much we rely on our senses to tell us everything about the world around us, that the only evidence, if you can call it that, that we have for an afterlife is our extreme desire for it to be so. Is there anything else that even compares with this in the human experience that you found?
Do you mean is there any other evidence for or against an afterlife, or do you mean is there anything else that's sort of parallel to afterlife?
That's parallel, or anything else that we completely believe in and that huge segments of human beings consider very precious, for which we don't have any sort of human experience that would prove or suggest that it is so?
Well, I mean, I think religion in general probably falls into this category. The available evidence seems to speak pretty clearly against anybody's particular religion. This is not to say that something much more interesting might not be going on. In other words, let me just back up one step. I don't call myself an atheist because I think we know too little. I mean, I know we know too little. If you just look at the mysteries in science in 2010 that we know about, it's things like, I mean, take the fact that 90% of the mass of the cosmos, we don't know where it is, and so we call it dark matter, it's just a label by which we're sweeping it under the rug and saying, well, gosh, we can't see it, we can't detect it, but we know it must be there because otherwise the gravity equations wouldn't work out. So we don't know that. We don't know how to build consciousness from pieces and parts. You know, the brain is made of hundreds of billions of cells, and somehow you get this private subjective experience on top of that, but we don't know how to build something like that. We don't know why mass and energy are equivalent. We don't know lots of things. So that's the stuff we know we don't know, and on top of that is all the stuff that we don't even know we don't know. So given the vastness of the mystery that surrounds us, I definitely do not call myself an atheist. I think there might be something really interesting going on.
But you don't call yourself an agnostic either, right?
Right, and I don't call myself an agnostic. And in fact, I'll return to that point in a second. The thing I want to say at the opposite end of the spectrum, though, is that I definitely don't – I wouldn't commit to any particular religion because, because they're so provably untrue. You know, if you look at, let's say, the Judeo-Christian Bible with its account that the earth is 6,000 years old, you know, the Magdalenians were painting caves and the Japanese were domesticating goats and the Persians were making pottery. And so, you know, this was all 10,000 years ago before the planet existed, according to the Bible. So there are a lot of, you know, there are a lot of deep troubles with it. That's just the start of it. So I can't commit to any particular religion. So, yeah, that puts me somewhere in the middle. I don't call myself an agnostic only because the term, as it's usually used, is sort of a weak term by which people mean I'm not certain if the story that my parents taught me is true or not true. That's usually where agnosticism ends, is just sort of this uncertainty about it. But because I'm interested in actively exploring the possibility space, because I'm interested in actively saying, well, what else could be going on, I call myself a possibilian. And possibilianism has been this really funny movement over the last year and a quarter, ever since I introduced it on National Public Radio about a year and a quarter ago. It just went nuts. When I did it at the time, there were zero Google hits for it. The word didn't exist. And now there's over 10,000 hits, and it's become, it's been written about in sort of every newspaper and magazine in the world, and it's just a joke movement because possibilianism specifically doesn't subscribe to anybody's particular story. It's all about just understanding what the structure of the possibility space is. It's not interested in committing to one story over another in the absence of good evidence to do so, good reason to do so. So the fact that it's sort of caught on fire like that has really been a crack up and a pleasure to watch, because I think what it probably indicates is that maybe people are getting a little tired of the debates between the strict atheist on one hand and the religious fundamentalists on the other hand, both of whom polarize each other and spend all their energies saying there is a God, there's not a God, and maybe there's something much more interesting than either of those positions.
Well, and the reality is that the vast majority of people fall well within those two very extreme boundaries.
I guess that's true. It's hard to tell from survey data, because when you look at surveys that are taken in America, people certainly don't, if they are in between those, they don't admit it so much. I mean, you know, yeah, I think it's, I don't remember the numbers exactly, but it's something like 70% of Americans believe in angels. And, you know, a higher percentage than that believe in whatever God they happen to get poured into their nervous system. I mean, the thing is, let me just take one second to make a tangential point here, which is that it doesn't take an anthropologist to realize when you look around the globe that whatever society you're born into, you absorb that religion and you love it. And in cases, people will fight and die for it. So if you're born in Saudi Arabia, you will love Islam. And if you're born in Springfield, Ohio, you'll love Protestantism. In Italy, you're going to love Catholicism and so on. And the thing is that people everywhere take these things very seriously and feel as though, okay, well, I was the one who happened to be born into the right spot and everyone else is wrong. And they'll really fight for these things. But of course, as Richard Dawkins pointed out, everyone knows what it's like to be an atheist, because all you need to do is look at somebody else's religion and you think, well, that's patently ridiculous that you would believe in that. And of course, they're looking back at you and thinking the same thing. So it's a little troubling that people take their local stories so seriously and deep down believe that that's the right one and everyone else is wrong. If there really were one right one, you would expect that over time everyone would sort of gravitate to it. But of course, that's not what has happened, and there's no indication that that would happen. So, I forgot where this was going.
Well, let me ask you this. Did you find yourself at any point, as you wrote all these stories and imagined what they could be, that by some change maybe in your basic makeup or your orientation as a scientist, that you could believe one of them really completely?
Sorry, one of the stories in some, or one of the stories in the world?
One of the stories anywhere of afterlife. Nope. Is there part of you that's tempted? No?
Nope, not at all. Not at all. I'll tell you why, because the scientific temperament is one that's very open-minded to putting lots of hypotheses out on the table. And then what you do is you gather evidence to weigh in favor of one of these over the others. That's how science actually proceeds. But there are many cases in which you have a whole bunch of hypotheses on the table, and you can't get any good evidence, at least not yet, that weighs in favor of one over the other. And so science's table is wide and accommodating, and you just hold multiple narratives in your head at once, and that's okay. Those are the terms of the agreement we have with Mother Nature a lot of the time. Take something like quantum physics. There are two vastly different interpretations of what underlies quantum physics, and we don't know yet, and there are no tests that would distinguish the two hypotheses, and so that's fine. That's part of the agreement we have. We say, okay, well, it could be this or it could be that. And I think when it comes to something like the afterlife, I certainly know of zero good evidence that would tell us one way or another anything about it, whether it exists at all, and if so, what it would look like. So I'm happy to keep the whole possibility space, the millions of possible stories in mind at the same time, including the story, of course, that there is no afterlife at all and that we just go into an infinite sleep.
David Eagleman is my guest. He's director of the Laboratory for Perception and Action at Baylor College of Medicine. His book is called Some, 40 Tales from the Afterlives.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is director of the Laboratory for Perception and Action at Baylor College of Medicine, David Eagleman. His book is called Some, 40 Tales from the Afterlives. It's just been re-released in paperback. Jen in Denton writes, I first heard Some on Radiolab and love that you allowed yourself to write despite or perhaps to spite the expectations of scientists. Have you received attention or support within your field for the book, or has it been a very separate endeavor?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. It's been quite separate. In fact, I never, ever mention around here in the hallways of my work at Baylor College of Medicine, I never tell anybody that I'm a fiction writer. And in fact, I wrote this book over the course of 7 years when I was at a place called the Salk Institute and then when I came back here to the Texas Medical Center in Houston. And I never told any of my colleagues I was doing this. I think that some have found out now, but I just keep my mouth shut around here. But I don't know why, but I think it's sort of risky to do this in an academic career. I wish it weren't. I wish there were more appreciation of this sort of artistic endeavor, but it comes with some amount of risk, so I just keep my mouth shut.
Have you wondered why you are so fascinated by this, despite what you know and believe as a scientist?
Well, I think it's exactly consistent with science in the sense that, as I said before, science is all about asking big questions and coming up with hypotheses about it, and when you can gather evidence, then you do. But there's this understanding that at this moment in the 21st century, there are some questions that are just beyond the ken of science, and in that case, you can still generate the hypotheses and think about the questions, even if you can't bring the armamentarium of modern neuroscience to bear on answering those questions. So I feel like it's totally consistent. Also, as an undergraduate, I majored in British and American literature, and that was always, being a writer was a love of mine since I was a child. So I've always pursued fiction writing as a side gig.
I talked to the astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson a few months ago on the show, and he said it was possible that our human brains had not yet evolved to the extent that it was possible for us to understand everything in the universe. Do you agree with that, or do you think we're smart enough right now, potentially, without changing, to know everything?
Oh, yeah. No, he's completely correct about that. There was a British physicist named Haldane who said, the universe is not only queerer than we suppose, it's queerer than we can suppose, by which he meant there's when we really start understanding the fabric of reality, let's say at the scale of quantum mechanics, you find that it's not the kind of thing that our brains evolved to deal with. So our brains evolved at this particular space and time scale. So we're really good at chasing rabbits and finding apples and finding mates, but we're really bad at understanding what's going on with atoms at the scale of the very small. So, you know, it's interesting to me, though, that I feel like the people who could understand that stuff the best would be young children whose brains are still plastic. But we still teach children these very wrong models. You know the model of the atom where you have these electrons going around the nucleus like a solar system?
Sure, yeah.
Well, that's been wrong for 105 years. That's been just dead wrong. And yet we still teach kids that because we figure, well, we as adults get it, so maybe they'll get it too. But I don't see why we couldn't teach children quantum mechanics, what we know to already be true, teach them that from a young age, and then maybe we could make steps towards having brains that could really understand the fabric of reality in ways that our old fogey brains just can't.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Monique in Dallas. Hi, Monique.
Yes, hi. I'm calling from Dallas. I always love your show, and today's topic is extremely interesting to me, so I want to thank you for bringing this to us.
Sure.
I feel like I'm hearing from a kindred spirit. I'm a Possibilian, and I didn't know it. what I wanted to comment on specifically was the story, which I look forward to reading, about mirrors and seeing ourselves as others do. I've been toying with this idea. I'm a writer, and I've been toying with this idea that if I saw how other people saw me kind of from a multi-narrator perspective, I wonder if I'd actually like myself. We tend to be very critical of people because we only see them from one side. And anyway, I just wanted to share that observation that there are other people out there thinking some of the same things you are, and I appreciate it.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you so much, Monique. Yeah, it's a tough question. When you start reaching your arms down into this question of, gosh, how do other people see me, and would I like myself if I knew how everyone saw me? Yeah, I think it's just a really good, fast inroad into, well, into understanding the joys and complexities of being human, which is the goal of the book. So this was one of 40 inroads where I hoped to sort of quickly get in there and make you think, oh, God, what would that be like? Thank you for that, Monique.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we'll speak with Adnan in Addison. Hi, Adnan.
Hey, Chris, very nice show, first of all. Yeah, two questions. First question is about time, how time synchronizes with the abilities to perceive when we talk about extrasensory perceptions, like meditative states. When you talk about sleep modes, you have certain like alpha brain waves. When you talk about time, how does time coincide with that? Is it a temporal matter? Can it be measured with time? Same goes with hypnosis age regression. When you talk about all these things, how does time correlate with that? That's my first question.
Well, let's see if we can get an answer for that.
About afterlife, as Egyptians used to do, as I've heard, to my knowledge, they used to save queens and kings' minds or brains in order to save that pineal gland, which is called dimethyltryptamine. And how does that, and the brain releases massive amount of dimethyltryptamine when human life is ending physically. Now,
well, let's see if we can get an answer to both of those ideas anyway.
Okay. Well, let me do them in reverse order. So as far as the afterlife, as far as the Egyptians holding on to brains and the pineal gland, unfortunately that was something that didn't lead anywhere, but I think when we look back in 10,000 years, we'll see that was the first step in an effort that maybe is becoming more sophisticated, which is eventually we might be able to download people's consciousness in a way that they don't have to die. So the computational view of the brain says, look, you've got these billions of pieces and parts operating in some complicated patterns, and maybe if we could just reproduce that in zeros and ones on a computer, then that would be equivalent to you. Maybe we don't need the wet, biological, gushy stuff. We just need the algorithms, the computer programs, essentially, that are running on that wetware. So if that's true, and there's only one way to know in the future, is, you know, we'll have to try it, is then it means that we actually can download people's brains, and as the Egyptians tried unsuccessfully to do, we can actually keep people alive even after the physical body fails. As far as time goes, the thing with meditation or sleep, you know, it's interesting. It's a young field, and there are all sorts of open questions there. I've personally been very fascinated by this issue of time in dreams and how that operates, because sometimes you can have a very short dream and you wake up and you feel like it took a long time. I think this, again, just illustrates this principle that time is a construction of the brain, and whatever your brain tells you has happened, then that's what you end up believing. And there are all sorts of disorders where people can think that things take longer or shorter. And it's even the case that as people age normally, time seems to speed up for people. A childhood summer lasts much longer than a summer in old age. And I have, you know, I have a theoretical understanding of why that happens.
Why does it happen?
Well, it turns out that time and memory are so tightly intertwined that what we've discovered just in the last few years is the more your brain is writing down memories, the more densely you're writing new memories, then the longer something seems to have lasted retrospectively. So when you're a kid, everything's new, and you have this childhood summer, all these new experiences, you write it all down. When you get to the end of the summer and you look back, you feel like that took forever. As an older person, you've sort of gotten the patterns of the world. You've already sort of seen it all before in some sense. And as a result, you're not writing much down. And when you look back at the end of the summer, you think, my God, where did it go? I was just going into my cubicle every day and doing the same thing, and it just seemed, you know, 10 years have blinked past.
What's amazing about that is it makes me think of when you drive somewhere for the first time, it always seems longer on the way there than on the way home.
That's exactly right. And the first day that you're driving to your new workplace, it feels like a long drive, and after a while, going to the same place seems very short. So what I often tell people is, you know, I can't necessarily tell you how to live longer, but I can tell you how to make it seem like you've lived longer. And that is, you know, just do novel things every day. Do things that shake up your brain and lay down new memories, including driving a different route home from work every day. You know, just taking, instead of taking the same roads. And you can do all kinds of silly things like brush your teeth with your other hand or wear your watch on your other arm or, you know, just anything you can do to sort of shake it up a little bit. And, of course, any chance that you have to sign up for something that's kind of adventurous and out of the ordinary for you, you should.
And then when you get there, pay attention.
That's right. Show up and pay attention.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to John in Dallas. Hello, John.
Hi. A lot of the great Russian writers were physicians, Chekhov, Bulgakov, just to name a few. Are you familiar with their work? Were there any influence to you? And do you see any differentiation as being a physician writer versus a lawyer writer, a businessman writer, or just, you know, a waitress writer, something like that?
Thanks for that question. I mean, I think in general, I feel very lucky that I have a day job as a scientist because there's so much material that's always floating around as part of the background radiation here in this job. So every day I'm thinking, you know, 70 different thoughts about the brain and why the way we are and what emotions are about and how we're social creatures and so on. And because of that, there's so much fodder there for literature. And I think anybody who has a second job where they're doing something else just can't help but, if they're a writer deep on the inside, they can't help but accrete new ideas for stories every single day. So, yeah, I think having someone, I can't remember who now, but some famous author was asked to give advice to young writers, and he said, do something else besides be a writer. That was the advice. If you want to be a good writer, you have to accumulate other sorts of experiences.
Are there truths that you think science will never have the language to describe?
All I can say to that is I don't know. In our brief twinkling of a 21st century lifetime, I know for certain that there are things we won't get to the end of. And so, so I don't have any expectations that I'll know the answers to things even in 60 years. But it's really impossible to know what science will even look like 1,000 years from now or 10,000 years from now. And, of course, if you imagine going back, just imagine going back 400 years and taking some really smart guy like Isaac Newton and bringing him here to our century, it would blow his mind. He wouldn't even know how to start thinking about, I mean, you know, take him on an airplane and he's above the clouds and you tell him that the airplane's making 100,000 corrections a second by a computer chip and he doesn't know what a computer chip is. He doesn't even know what electricity is. It would just blow his mind. So imagine us in 400 years with this increased pace of discovery that we've got going on. It may be that the way we learn and understand, the way we sic computers on the problem to generate new hypotheses and come up with answers, and the way we educate our children to understand how to think about the fabric of reality or even how to think about giant data patterns and data mining might make it so that it's so that our little poor brains wouldn't understand it, but 1,000 years from now, humans might be very different than what we would even recognize.
It is sort of agonizing to be able to conceive of a time when we have solved a lot of problems and come to understand a lot of things that we know for a fact we won't get to in our own lifetimes.
Well, that's the exciting part. And, of course, this is what attracts some people to cryonics, where they want to freeze themselves for, you know, 500 years and then get thawed out, because you could see a world that's very different and hopefully quite exciting.
Would you do that if you believed it were possible?
I would only do it if I were with other people that I loved, because it would be extremely lonely to wake up in a world where you're a stranger to everyone. Everyone that you've ever known and loved has been dead for half a millennium. That would be very lonely, I think.
Are you still writing these stories, David, or are you done with this for now and moving on to something else?
Well, no, I am. I'm writing my next fiction book. For better or worse, I have my next 6 books under contract, and
they're all
nonfiction books, and they're all very exciting. I'm really jazzed about them. My next book is coming out early next year. It's about the unconscious brain and how most of what we think and do and act and believe is generated by parts of our brain that we don't even have access to, or we're not even acquainted with. So that book's coming out.
We will have you back as soon as it's on the shelves.
Great.
David Eagleman is director of the Laboratory for Perception and Action at Baylor College of Medicine. His new book is called Some 40 Tales from the Afterlives. You can also read about his work online in the May issue of the Texas Observer. David, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.